So that it's been a very nice day so far, and this is the first time I've sat in here, and it feels like a very nice place to sit. I hope it was for you. It seemed particularly nice with the rain. It seemed maybe extra still today, maybe because of the rain. The rain sometimes creates a kind of stillness in the space, and a little bit different stillness when it was raining as from when it wasn't raining, but kind of still. And then this way these beams are, they remind me of the inside of a boat, an upside down boat. So if it rains too much, we turn it around, turn it over, and float away. I want to talk, or try to talk, a little bit more about this mind of freedom that I mentioned this morning, the mind of non-clinging. And I thought by starting, maybe trying to give some examples. A year or so ago, I went to the symphony in San Francisco, San Francisco Symphony, and I haven't gone to many concerts in my life, and I hadn't gone for many, many years before that one. So it was kind of a new event for me. And we were given these wonderful box tickets kind of hovering right over the kind of stage. And I felt like royalty. And it was very nice. But also you could see really well. You could see, you kind of look right down into on top of the orchestra. And since it was all very new to me, I found myself the first half of the concert being preoccupied with what I was seeing. And I was just kind of like looking at, especially the conductor who was doing all the stuff with his arms, and I was more interested in him than the music. And I was watching this guy kind of doing what he's doing, and I was wondering, what is he doing, and what are the players picking up, and who is he really waving at and pointing at, and so all these thoughts and concerns. Then I go look at the drummers, and some of them were just sitting there waiting, and I'd look at them and wondering why they were waiting, and all these kinds of thoughts, right? And after a while I noticed that I wasn't listening to the music at all. I was caught up in what I was seeing. And so then I decided, well, I'm here to hear the music, not to kind of watch these characters. So I closed my eyes for the rest of the first half. And by closing my eyes, I could concentrate, I could be present more for the music, and it was really delightful then to hear the music, and which was what I thought I'd come to be there for. And then after the intermission, I got kind of used to being present. I'd calmed down somewhat. My mind wasn't so judging everyone in the orchestra pit anymore. And I found that I was actually able to be present with my eyes open. And then rather than becoming a distraction to watch all these people, actually watching the orchestra became part of the beauty of it all. Was just somehow the movements of all the different instruments and the conductor and the sounds of the music at the same time. It all became one large kind of production that was quite pleasant and enjoyable to watch. But it struck me, that it took a while for me to get to that place where I could just kind of receive it without getting caught up in the details of it. So this ability to have a mind, have a kind of awareness which doesn't get caught up by what it sees or what it hears or the details, but rather can allow things to arise and pass in and of itself, is something which, at least in a concert, is, I think, often preferable, allows you to experience it most fully. And then many of us have the experience, for example, of going up maybe backpacking and going out into nature by ourselves or something. And especially if you go up into the Sierras for maybe a few days or a week or 10 days by yourself or even with someone else, some of the things that we get caught up by in our normal life don't seem to have the same hold on us. And after maybe 4 or 5 days up in the Sierras, you kind of think back at your life back in Palo Alto or wherever it is, and you say, well, how could I have been so caught up? Somehow we get some perspective, a different kind of perspective in our life when we're up in the Sierras and it's just ourselves and nature and the sky and pretty relaxed and taking it easy. And the perspective teaches us that some of the things that we get caught up in normal life are pretty petty. And we don't care so much. If someone comes along and maybe criticizes you up there, you kind of shrug it off much more. It's much easier. You know, who cares if what they think about me? Whereas if down here in Palo Alto, someone criticizes you, maybe it's a big deal. Or you pass someone on the trail and your shirt is your shirt tail's out of your pants. And you're up on the trail and, you know, who cares, right? Who could care less? But it's maybe down here, if you're not dressed just right, maybe, you know, you pass someone on the street and you're a little bit self-conscious because it becomes more important down here what we think other people think of us. The gist of what I'm trying to say is we can have an experience like going up into the mountains, and we can find ourselves much less likely to get caught up with the kind of concerns that maybe we often get caught up in our daily life. The mind is much more at ease. And we realize sometimes quite dramatically how much of our time our mind is caught up, preoccupied by different events. And how much more pleasant it is to not to be caught up, to let the mind be more spacious and allowing. The experience some people might have, maybe not in the Sierras, but if you do some vigorous exercise, and maybe for an hour or two, something really strenuous, and at the end of that time, you feel completely contented or satiated or completely at ease or maybe just exhausted or whatever. And there's a different kind of perspective that happens where you don't necessarily get caught by the same kind of concerns that you have otherwise. You feel content. You just lay there, perhaps kind of resting after all your exercise, and someone walks by who, if they'd walked by you 3 hours earlier, would have generated a lot of different feelings and ideas. Maybe you're less likely to be judgmental because you're so content. You're less likely to be worried about what they tell you because of this deep contentment that might be there. Many of us have experiences in our life where we have a feeling of kind of maybe contentment or fullness or wholeness or at ease with ourselves or a kind of sense of integrity, where the mind does not react so easily to what's going on around it. And so I'm just kind of trying to point to some different possibilities of that. Maybe some of you are struggling against the weather recently. And a few Mondays ago, I drove home in the middle of one of the huge, biggest downpours here. And it took me forever to get home. And I said, wow, more times in my life than I've ever had in one day. I was just driving along, wow. There's all this stuff that I was like, wow, you know, like these trees had fallen and big floods I had to drive through, and hopefully my car would get through the other side. And I live up in the mountains, and so I drove all the way up 84, all the way almost to the top of 84 to Skyline, until I had to turn around and go back down again because a tree had fallen down. So it's a long drive, right? So I go all the way down. Then I went up Kings Mountain Road, which is an alternative route. And Kings Mountain Road was like a river, the whole thing. It was big, gushy, muddy kind of. And I wondered sometimes what I was driving over. Wow. And it was quite something, you know, and I couldn't see very well. And I wanted to get home because my family was home. And, you know, how were they like? And so I finally got home. And after all that kind of involvement and presence, I was really present in a kind of full way. And I came home and I was so peaceful and so contented that any one of you could have insulted me quite nicely, and he would have just rolled right off, you know. Sometimes some people have the experience, maybe sometimes making love, the end of lovemaking, just laying there and just so contented that no sense of personal identity matters anymore. You're not holding on to some idea that you have to be something for anybody. It's just enough just to be alive, just laying there. It's enough just to be alive. This idea that it's enough just to be alive is very closely akin to the mind of freedom, the mind that doesn't cling. So we get so often caught up in things and what people think of us and the way we want to present ourselves to others. I did a workshop a few weekends ago on mindfulness in speaking. It was interesting because in various ways. A very interesting weekend. One line of footnote to it was, when I told people I was going to do this workshop, many people assumed I was going to be talking about a right speech, or the third precepts, you know, not to lie or something. And they only associated the idea of mindful speaking with ethical speaking. And I was not in particular interested in ethics for this workshop, just about bringing attention to the way in which we speak, and our speech itself as a field of mindfulness. I call it the fifth foundation of mindfulness. But as part of the, as the weekend went on, one of the things, when the paradoxes came out, was people talked about how valuable it was. Part of speaking, we talked about listening and really being listened to, and the experience when you really feel someone listens fully to you. So we talked about what it's like when we experience someone who really sees us fully. And people talked about how satisfying it is to really be seen fully for who they are. And they talked about how what that meant for them was things like, someone really sees you for the full range of all the ways in which you are, you're good and you're bad and whatever, and even so, they totally accept you for who that is. It felt very nice. Most of us want to be seen that way. And then a little bit later, we talked about all the ways in which we edit the way we are, so we can be seen in a particular way. We want to be seen by people in a certain way. We don't want people to see we're foolish or that we're judgmental or that we're don't know we're confused or whatever. And so we kind of present ourselves, we select the way we present ourselves in order to create an image for the other person, we kind of present ourselves in a certain way. And the paradox is, or the irony is, that on one hand, a lot of people on the weekend most wanted was to be seen fully for who they were. On the other hand, they were busy preventing that by only presenting certain parts of who they were. So there's ways in which we get caught in our daily life is a lot to do with our identity, who we think we are, who I am. So, and often the way in which we kind of create an identity of me and mine, what's myself, is in relationship to the ways in which we get caught. And you might be able to argue, I could maybe argue, that the problematic sense of self that Buddhism is trying to clarify or penetrate or let go of arises only when we get when we're caught up. It arises if we don't get caught up, that problematic sense of self wouldn't exist. Being caught or preoccupied or hooked onto something is the very nature of the problematic sense of self, of separate sense of self. And in these various kinds of experiences, some of us can have in our normal life, we get a sense of the possibility of living in a way that doesn't get caught up by anything. A possibility, that kind of mind that's at ease, that's maybe the kind of mind that's as big as the sky in the high Sierras, that holds it all, that sees it all, that's at ease, that's penetrated as translucent or as transparent. But as I said this morning, most of us relate to our life in the form of objects. We relate to objects, we relate to things. Maybe because we're insecure and so if we're afraid, we better look outside and kind of look at the threats or the perceived threats or the anticipated threats or whatever. And so we relate to those things out there. Or we have desires and things we want to fulfill or ways in which we want to build ourselves up. And so we relate to the things that'll do that. And mostly, most of us are relating to things, to objects. And most of our suffering that arises because of that kind of, because of objectification, because we relate to things as objects outside of ourselves. And in a sense, the objectification of reality is understood in Buddhism to be one of the great forms of ignorance, which is a source of suffering. And it isn't that it's necessarily wrong to see things as objects or see things out there in the world or see ourselves, see the objects within ourselves. But to cling to it and hang on to it is a problem. And some of us, what we do in normal life is to relate only to the objects, things that we can call objects, inside ourselves or outside of ourselves. But where it gets a very interesting, what a spiritual practice has to offer is something which is diametrically opposed to being constantly involved in objects, things that are going to do it for us, things that we have to be afraid of, building ourselves up, protecting ourselves against things, acquiring money and cars and houses and all the kind of things that for some of people provide a sense of identity. Rather than always looking outside for the validation for who we are, what the spiritual practice challenges us to do is to do kind of a 180-degree turn, radical turn around, away from the objects, in a sense, to look at the mind that doesn't cling, the mind that doesn't hang on to any of the objects. The mind of freedom doesn't need any objects. It's kind of like the space in this room. You know, most of us will tend to look at the objects in the room, but the space in the room tends oftentimes to go unnoticed. The mind that doesn't cling is kind of like that space. But, you know, what good is it? You can't see it. Where does it exist? Can you point to it? That kind of mind is invisible. It has no color. It has no place. It has no location. It has no smell. You can't point to it very easily. So if you can't find it or smell it or taste it or touch it or anything, what is it? You know, it's not even transparent, because if something's transparent, you have to assume that you can at least have some sense where it is to look through it. Where's that mind of non-clinging? You can't find it. So it's kind of infuriating, because you can't get to it somehow. But it's actually the very water, it's the air, it's the water the fish swims in, it's the air the bird flies in, this kind of the mind of non-clinging, awareness itself. But because it's not an object, because it doesn't do anything the way objects do for us, or we anticipate they do for us, we often overlook it, we don't notice it. And so we don't give it credit, or we don't rest in it, or we don't appreciate its presence here. And so we tend then to look at the objects, and the objects are going to do it for us, and then we get caught up by them and cling to them. So I've told this story before, but there was one 10-day retreat I sat a few years ago, where I made the mind of non-clinging the sole practice of the, or one of the main practices of the retreat. And it took, one of the places it took, it played out was at the end of the sittings. And Vipassana retreats is always the option, pretty much, unless you have a strict teacher, that you can always just sit in. After when the bell rings and it's time to end the sitting, you can just keep sitting. You can sit forever. No one's going to notice or care. And you just keep sitting. So, and it's often quite nice if you're quite settled and concentrated, just really nice and very, very seductive to keep sitting, because it's so nice. And who wants to get up and walk? Because walking is, might be cold out there. So, so I would sit, and at the end of the sitting, I'd sometimes be quite concentrated, and maybe sometimes I'd feel a lot of pleasure in my sitting, or a lot of joy. And it would often be kind of a desire to stay and stay sitting. But I made the practice that what I was orienting myself to was the mind of non-clinging, not the mind of pleasure, not the mind of joy. So when the bell rang at the end of the sitting, that for me was a signal to get up and do the walking practice. And so I would get up and walk. And as I got up, some of this calm and some of the settledness I had would disappear a little bit, kind of, but what didn't disappear was the mind of non-clinging. The calm might have kind of waned a little bit, but I was orienting myself to the mind that doesn't cling, the mind that doesn't stick to anything. And that actually got strengthened by just getting up and going on to the next thing. The mind that doesn't cling. It's the mind that can listen to a symphony most fully and appreciate it most fully. And I use that example at the beginning because sometimes people say, what good is it to have the mind of non-clinging? And maybe it's not supposed to have any good. Maybe it's not supposed to have any purpose. And to ask for one is to ask for trouble. It's just supposed to be, it's enough just to be alive. You don't have to have a reason for it. But even so, I think just like the experience of the symphony was much more satisfying when I could listen to it without getting caught by any of the objects in the symphony. in orchestra. So in the same way, I think life is much more fulfilling, much more satisfying when we can rest in this mind that doesn't cling and appreciate the possibility of that and to recognize when it happens. It happens probably much more often in degrees than many of us give ourselves credit for. And it could be very simple things. Sometimes just simply sitting, having a hot cup of tea at the end of a busy day. Sometimes there can be a flavor of a mind that doesn't cling, the mind of freedom, right there and drinking it. There's no need to be anybody anymore. There's no resistance to anything around you, and no building a sense of self, no protecting a sense of self. You're just having a cup of tea and looking out the window, and that's all that's happening. And it might have the flavor of this non-clinging quite nicely. And it's there, and we tend not to notice it. One of the things that's often useful to do is to start noticing more often the movements or the presence of a mind which allows things to be much more. The mind is not caught up by things, that flows with things in a sense. So we say often enough, it's part of the liturgy of the Vipassana movement, is this famous teaching to a man named Bahiya. The Buddha, Bahiya, came to the Buddha, and he said, it's pretty uncertain how long I'm going to live or how long you're going to live, O Buddha. So since things are pretty uncertain how long we're going to be around, you better teach me your teaching in a nutshell. Give me the essence of it. And so the Buddha at first was kind of reluctant to say anything because he was busy doing other things. He said, "Not now," he said. "Would you wait?" I have to finish what I'm doing. And Bahiya kept insisting, "No, it's uncertain how long you are going to live. Please do it now. I don't know when I'll get the chance again." Kind of a sense of urgency about it. And so then the Buddha said, "Okay, I'll give you the teachings in a nutshell." And the Buddha said, very beautiful, I think very beautiful, and people who do mindfulness practice can maybe have a sense of how beautiful this is, this statement. He said, "In the seen, just let there be the seen. In the heard, just let there be the heard. In the smell, just let there be the smell. In the tasted, just let there be the taste. In the touched, just let there be the touched. In the cognized, just let there be the cognized." Something like that. And then the Buddha went on. But that's often quoted in the Vipassana circle. That's the little statement. In what you see, just let there be the seen. Let it occur in the mind that doesn't cling. Let it just be there by itself without the judgments or the analysis or the criticism or the resistance to it. Just let it be there as it is itself. Let it arise and float, in a sense, into the middle of it. Kind of imagine, you know, floating in the space of this big room here, this big auditorium. Just allowing it to be as it is. And that's a lot, you know, as most of you know, or all of you know all too well, is really the heart of Vipassana practice, is allowing things to be as they are, just to see things and allow it to be seen, to hear things and allow it just to be sound, to have cognized something, just let it be something cognized, not make anything more of it. The teachings of the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, the teachings of paying attention to the breath, paying attention to the body, paying attention to feelings, paying attention to mental states, paying attention to the contents of the mind, is in part a teaching of learning to do that in all aspects of our life, to allow things to surface and arise, the full glory, the full complications of our life, but allow it to arise without adding any of this, the caught-upness on top of it. And you might think, as often some people think occasionally, well, that's kind of a dull life, or that's be a boring life, or I'll be a sucker if I do that. I'll just be kind of pushover, or I won't be able to think about things or analyze or be responsible about anything if I'm just kind of allowing things to be there in a simple way. But many of the mental functions that we need to run our life don't depend on our self-identity. Don't depend on us being attached or caught up or anxious or resisting for them to be there. That many of the mental functions that kind of can responsibly take care of our life can actually maybe don't have anything to do with us as an individual at all, or us as a kind of the ways we identify with ourselves. It's not part of even our. It's possible for these things to run without necessarily our conscious willing them or wanting them. It just happens. I mean, for example, if you're eating your meal, knowing that you're still hungry and going down to get the next bite doesn't require an identity. You don't have to be a smart person or a beautiful person or, you know, or present yourself to other people in any kind of particular way. It just kind of can happen. A tremendous amount of beautiful things can happen without us being involved in kind of a sense. And it can be a kind of sense of grace to allow all these things to unfold through us and just allow them to be as they are. So when it says, in the seen, just the seen, in the heard, just the heard, it ends by saying, in the cognized, just the cognized. And the cognized, it means, in a sense, cognizing, cognition is just simply recognizing what is going on in the mind, what is going on in our inner life. And our inner life can be quite involved, and we just leave it alone, let it be as it is. What I'm trying to get across is it's not necessarily a passive experience in the sense that nothing's going on. It can be very creative, but we get out of the way. And it can be kind of a sense of grace for that. And a lot of what we're learning in mindfulness practice is learning how to allow all the experiences of our breath, our body, our feelings, our emotions, our mental states to rise and pass in this trustful way, within this mind of freedom and this mind of non-clinging. And one way of understanding the instructions in the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, it's also instructions that these are the places where we tend to get caught. And what we're learning is to recognize how we tend to get caught by our body, our physical, you know, ideas about ourselves, our physical body and our concerns with our health and all these things. We get caught by these things. Or our feelings, we get caught by our feelings, pleasant and unpleasant. Our emotions, we get caught by them. Our hindrances, our, you know, the patterns of the mind, we get caught by them. And the Four Foundations of Mindfulness are teaching us to pay attention to ways we get caught, and then learning to hold all that in the mind that doesn't cling, in the mind of freedom, which is always here anyway. It's not something which is you have to make happen. So this mind of non-clinging, our mind, awareness itself, it sometimes has no location. It's not out there, it's not in here. It's not defined by something out there, it's not defined by something in here. It just exists there kind of in its own way, in its own kind of beautiful, I don't know what. But you can't find it. So how do you relate to something you can't find? So what do you think? So that's enough for me. So you have any comments or questions? When you find it, tell me.
It feels like
it's here. Here in front of you?
Yeah.
A little bit in front of you, like here? You think so? And that little guy is your awareness?
Hmm?
That little guy is your awareness?
I guess. It seems like it has location.
Yeah, okay. Maybe so in your case, then. The more I practice, the less I can find it. Or the more I find it everywhere. When I first started practicing, if someone asked me where my awareness was, I would have pointed here. And now I don't do that anymore. And if I was going to, my first pointing now would perhaps be a pointed. I just say here, kind of my whole body. But I think actually, for me, a more truer answer would be just kind of like it's everywhere. Then awareness and objects of awareness are inseparable. They all awareness resides in what I'm aware of. Which kind of it's just It's the stuff, it's like the water a fish swims in. I can't find it. But, you know, I could be wrong. And you could be right. Yeah.
You're equating awareness and the mind of non-clinging. It sounds like you are, right?
I guess, you know, unless you get too technical, yes. I mean, I you know, these words are pretty imprecise, you know, awareness, and, you know, but I'm comfortable enough equating them.
You said the mind of non-clinging is always present, and there's nothing that we have to do.
Well, you know. Who knows if it's always present? I don't know. But, you know, every time I check, it seems to be always present. You know, every time I... you know, it's kind of a metaphysical statement to say it's always present. You know, it's always there. I'm a little reluctant to make statements like that because who really knows? But the sense or the experience of it is that's the case.
Well, I'm not trying to be metaphysical. The question is, when you're caught in clinging, when you know that you're caught in clinging, that's a very different experience from, you know, it's like at the symphony, when you knew that you were caught up in watching all of this, as opposed to when you weren't.
Yeah.
So do you actively non-cling? Do you bring up the mind of non-clinging?
Yes. It all depends. You know, I don't have, you know, it depends on the situation and what seems appropriate. I mean, in that symphony, I closed my eyes because I was so caught up in it. And that seemed to be, you know, it was what I did at the time, so I can listen to it. What another thing I could have done was I could have actually turned inward and studied the energy inside of me of clinging, the energy of preoccupation, the energy of judgment. I was judging all those people up there. The conductor was, he's foolish up there, you know, waving his arm too much. Just calm down. And I could have looked at the energy inside of me and seen the judgment and seen the aversion or whatever and just kind of been with that until it was settled. And just a bit allowed for that. Allow aversion to be aversion, just see it clearly for what it is. And then that in itself is a wonderful thing to do. But however, I'm still not listening to the concert. So because the agenda for the evening was listening to the concert, I didn't want to just kind of do choiceless awareness with whatever is arising. I wanted to really be there for the concert, so I closed my eyes. So it depends on the situation, what you want to decide to do. But sometimes, you know, so what happened at the end of the concert was I was much more there. You know, I didn't have to close my eyes. I could listen to the music beautifully, and I could watch this beautiful movement in the orchestra pit, and all these people were doing all these things, and the conductor was kind of gracefully kind of moving his arms now, and it was quite fun and interesting to watch. And part of the whole orchestra, the whole wonderful phenomena, was I would still get caught at times. But I wasn't getting caught as dramatically. And then the caughtness would just be part of the whole thing. It wasn't like a problem, or it wasn't like it was getting in the way. It was just part of the unfolding of what was happening. I wasn't resisting or judging my caughtness even. It just would come and go like the music would come and go. It was no problem, even with that. In a scene, just a scene. So in the caught, just a caught. You know, when you're caught, just be caught. Don't add anything to it. You know, don't add another layer of caughtness on top of it. And one way to add another level of caughtness on top of being caught is decide, now I'm going to practice with it. I'm going to practice with my caughtness. You know, that's a good thing to do, but it's better just to be free. And one way to be free is just to be mindful of it. So you don't want to confuse mindfulness with a practice. Mindfulness is just allowing things to be and seeing clearly what it is. To practice is to try to do something. A technique, you know, I'm going to do this mindfulness practice so that. So just be caught. And the caught, just the caught. And then, I don't know, and then also, I mean, sometimes I have the sense that I can, the presence in my life, or the degree to which I can sense or feel this mind of non-clinging, or the mind of freedom, its omnipresence, or whatever, varies from time to time. Sometimes I'm much more attuned to it than others, and I don't exactly know why. It's kind of sometimes stronger and sometimes, you know, seems to be a weaker part of my life. But if it's strong enough, then sometimes what I can do is just kind of orient myself towards that, rather than trying to orient myself towards more mindfulness of what's actually going on. So this mind of freedom is really, in some sense, the heart of Buddhist practice, and the inclination of Buddhist practice, or it's hard to speak sometimes. I don't want to make it sound like it's just too much of a goal either. But the goal of Buddhist spiritual life is to, in a sense, experience or rest in the mind that doesn't cling, in the mind of freedom. And what is possible is to make that a priority for one's life. That what has the greatest priority is not having more joy, or not having a better job, or not having more money, or not having more whatever, but rather the priority of one's life is to orient one's life around the possibility of having a mind which doesn't cling, or having a heart which is free, the mind or the heart of freedom, and to really make that a priority. And it's a strange priority to have, because it's one of these priorities you can't find, right? It doesn't exist anywhere. Where do you find it? You can't. It's not any good. It's like a badge you can wear, and everybody can see, oh, now, look at Gil. He has the mind of non-clinging. Now, I can't find it, so can you find it? So it doesn't do you any good, exactly, but it's a great thing. So Buddhist spirituality is, in a sense, someone who's practicing mindfulness from a real Buddhist perspective, which you don't have to, from a real Buddhist perspective, is to place in the center of one's life this as a priority, as a highest value or something, this mind of freedom, so that everything is kind of referenced in a sense to that, so that you go about your daily life. And are you doing it? Does that have priority to stay in this, or approach, or to be in touch with, or be informed by, or be inspired by the mind that doesn't cling, the mind of freedom? Or is what's motivating your life all the kind of sundry things that we might, you know, get caught up in normal activities? It isn't that we have to not do our normal activities. You can do everything you're doing already. You don't have to stop doing anything. But in the midst of all that, what has highest priority is the mind that doesn't cling, is the mind of freedom. And it's all too easy, I know in my own life, it's all too easy to lose touch in that and get caught up in other concerns. And then suddenly other things seem really important. It's, you know, it's much more important. My job is much more important. My advancement is much more important. What my father thinks is much more important. And what my wife thinks is much more important, or, you know, whatever. And I get caught by those things. But, you know, it's possible to have at the heart of one's life, the inclination of one's life, this mind that doesn't cling, or the inspiration of it. And that, I think, is, you know, one of the ways of understanding Buddhist spirituality, is one that really is informed or inspired about this mind that doesn't cling. And it's something I'm sure all of you have experienced in some form or other. So it isn't like a foreign thing. It isn't like a strange mystical thing which, you know, if you huff and puff and practice enough, you'll find. I'm going on and on here. What else? Yes?
It seems to me that forgiving that clinging is one way of stopping it. If I don't then find myself clinging to the forgiveness.
Yes. I like the word forgiving because it has the word giving in it. And we're just giving it up, in a sense. Offering it up. Giving the word give up apparently originally came from the idea of offering something up, like an offering, making a sacrifice. So forgiving, to give something up. It's kind of an illusion to think that you become free, that we you know, I attain my freedom, now I'm a free person, that enlightenment is now I'm enlightened. I think rather the idea that when you become free or become enlightened, what's really happening is, it doesn't happen to you, it's what happens to everything in the world. You're giving everything in the world its freedom. So in a sense, when you forgive something, perhaps you're actually giving up your caughtness, your resentment, your judgment, and allowing it to be there as it is, giving it its freedom. So forgiveness seems fine. I think one of the values one of the possibilities that exists is sometimes in very deep meditative practice, like on retreats, for example, is to have an unequivocal experience of that somehow becomes a little bit of a kind of much more regular. I don't want to say permanent, but much more regular. Kind of cellular memory. So it's not just a matter of faith, it's something you really know for yourself in a much deeper way. But this morning when we started off, I offered two themes for the day. And one theme was the theme of honesty, and the other theme was that of the mind of freedom. And I think it's very important to hold both of them. And if you don't have, and if the sense of this, what I'm talking about doesn't make any sense, or you have no sense of visceral sense of what the mind of freedom or the mind of non-clinging is about, that's okay, you don't have to. And then the practice is just to practice honestly about what's really going on, to devote yourself to honesty, to be honest, to be really mindful of what's actually is your experience, to really have your own experience, let yourself be who you are fully. And then with time, I think that you'll get a sense, it'll grow and develop, and as there's more trust, as a trust that develops that allows yourself to be fully honest and present with what you're honest for, that trust itself will translate into a feeling more at ease in the mind that doesn't cling. Does that answer your concern? I don't know if I addressed you properly.
The word faith came up when you were talking about how can you find a thing that isn't there.
Yet. Faith is important.
We practice.
Yeah, maybe faith is important. I think faith is very important, and that maybe, I don't want to take that away from you. But what's reverberating inside my mind, this is an example. I don't know where all these things come from inside of me, even when I, you know. But my response inside my head when I listened to that was from Zen Mind Beginner's Mind, Suzuki Roshi says, it's very important to believe in nothing. Yes?
Suppose you have a really compelling practical problem. Say on April 15th, your taxes are due. You don't have enough.
Mine too. They are due.
And you don't have enough money to pay them. And you don't know what to do.
Yes.
And this is kind of grabbed you.
Ah. Oh, that's the condition. You've already been grabbed. See, I was going to ask you. So say you have a pressing problem and April 15 your taxes are due and you don't have the money to pay for it, and you know that the IRS is going to come and knock on your door with the sheriff. Is it necessary to get caught by that? Is it necessary to hold on to anything, to grab? Do you take, you take care of the situation better by grabbing? Or can you take the care of the situation just as responsibly, not grabbing at all?
Well, you don't want to be grabbed, but you wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning.
But you are.
And your mind starts running, oh my God, you know, they're going to come knocking on my door, take my Lexus.
Take your Lexus. You got problems.
So now, you know, the practice would say just to notice what's going on, where you're grabbed, right? You know, grab, stomach hurts, noting this, noting that. That's the practice. How does that relate to the mind of non-clean?
Well, one way perhaps is how just to be that and not add on top of that judgment, for example. Oh, God, I'm a terrible meditator. I've been caught. Gil's been talking about non-clinging, and I've been caught. What a terrible person I am, and now I'm embarrassed, and I better not go tell Gil, because Gil is going to judge me and hate me, and, you know, and whatever. So there's all these things we add on top of it. So in the cognized, just the cognized, means when you notice you're caught, can you allow just to be the caught? That's actually a very powerful way to begin. And not to add more suffering on top. It's bad enough to be caught that way. But we add all these layers beyond it. So part of the practice, the mind of non-clinging, is to see it clearly for what it is and allow it to be what it is without adding anything more to it.
So in this case, you'd wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning and you'd be worried.
Yeah.
Okay. So you would just hang out with the worry?
I would feel the worry in my body. I would sit. If I was really worrying a lot, I would probably get up and sit. And to really fully be present for the worrying as I can, and to really allow for it, be as honest as I can for it, and not just leave it as a cognitive event. You know, my worry is often an anxious mind kind of spinning all kinds of thoughts. But I would rather drop down into my body and feel the fear that's the source that's generating all these kinds of thoughts, and feel that fear in my body, and then feeling those fears in my body, again, just allow it to be there, trusting it's okay just to experience the fear in the body as it is. And as I experience the fear, just to be present for what happens as I'm with it. But to drop down into the body, it's very powerful to drop down into the body. You don't just stay up in your head with these things. But to drop down, what's happening in the feelings and the emotions and the experience in the body, and let the body process it. It's a lot easier to be get out of the way you know, what's going on inside of you. If you yield yourself to the body's experience of it.
But how is that? Does that produce the mind of no clinging when you do that?
Yes. Also, and again, Suzuki Roshi comes to mind in his book, Zen My Beginner's Mind. I forget exactly what he says, but there's a chapter in there where he talks about the importance of having... I don't remember anymore now, but I shouldn't quote him then, but the importance of having, if you have a regular committed practice, then that becomes a tremendous resource on the night of April 14th. if you don't have a regular committed practice and you don't ever sit, you think it's a good idea, you read a few books and it's really great, and then you try to sit April 14th, you don't have much strength and much momentum that's really going to help you at that point. But anyway, it's still far away, April 15th. I would recommend you get started now.
It was just an example.
Oh!
Nor do I want to like
it. Yes.
Is clinging the same as wanting?
No, wanting is just wanting, not necessarily wanting. It's pretty normal to want things.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you're hungry, you want to eat, right?
Mm-hmm.
If your bladder's full, you want to pee.
Mm-hmm.
And this wanting happens all the time. And wanting can be innocent. It can just be kind of a natural kind of whatever. I don't exactly know why wanting happens, but it can just happen. Clinging is when the wanting is anxious. You can have a wanting without anxiety. So an example is, it's fun. Oh, I'll read. How about ending with a quote? Our practice here is not to grasp anything, Ajahn Chah told a new monk. But isn't it necessary to hold on to things sometimes? The monk protested. With the hands, yes, but not with the heart, the teacher replied. When the heart grasps what is painful, it is like being bitten by a snake. And when through desire it grasps what is pleasant, it is just grasping the tail of the snake. And it only takes a little while longer for the head of the snake to come around and bite you. Make this non-grasping and mindfulness the guardian of your heart, like a parent. Then your likes and dislikes will come calling like children. I don't like that, Mommy. I want more of that, Daddy. Just smile and say, sure, kid. But, Mommy, I really want an elephant. Sure, kid. I want some candy. Can we go for an airplane ride? There's no problem if you can let them come and go without grasping. Something contacts the senses, like or dislike arises, and right there is delusion. Yet with mindfulness, wisdom can arise in the same experience. So you can have wanting without needing your wanting to be fulfilled. So wanting itself is fine. You can want, to become a multimillionaire. I want to be a multimillionaire sometimes. It'd be great to be a billionaire. I think, oh. just a thought that passes, just a kind of thought that passes through, right? I couldn't care less.
Did you mention the donation?
it was going to take a long time if I'm depending on that to become a billionaire. But who knows what's going to end up in there? So wanting is just, But to see the nature of wanting, to see that wanting doesn't have to see that you don't have to act on wanting is actually a very powerful moment of freedom. I think many of us are kind of lulled into the idea that we believe our wants, and we think we have to act on our wants. And you don't have to. You just leave your wants alone. Let them do what they want. You leave them alone, and they'll leave you alone. Enough for one day. So thank you all, and let's see, a couple of announcements. So there is two donation baskets up there, and in particular I encourage you to make the rent Donna donation, because we have to pay for the rent and we're all contributing for that, so $5 each. And the other basket is for me if you'd like. And next time we have a one-day sitting here is with Ajahn Amaro. It's March 14th. And The next one I do will be April 25th. It says in the schedule it's April 18th, but you shouldn't believe everything you read. So the 25th of April. We would greatly appreciate it if we can get a couple of volunteers to help clean up a little bit. We need someone to empty the trash, and we need someone to, or maybe a couple of people, I think there's two, maybe two people to mop, dust mop the floor here before we go home. So maybe three people could volunteer. Do we have three volunteers? Adam and I forgot your name.
Noah,
yeah. And Jennifer. Great, thank you. And anything else?
Have you determined yet if there will be a grant?
There, I think so. Well, there should be. Yeah. There's enough people. Anything else? Thank you.